Musical is alive and well. That's thank you for saying that, because I'm you know, I as someone who's been so sick of, you know, the past decade or whatever of people saying musicals are dead, I'm just like, no, they're not. Maybe they're sleeping occasionally, but well, they're still being made, and they still can be made, and I think they're still as relevant as ever, if not more so.
I think extremely so, and the timing of La La Land is so key. You know, a lot of people don't realize that Shirley Temple became a star because of the Depression of Franklin Roosevelt. He issued that executive order. You had to make happy movies, song and dance.
Fred
movies.
And Ginger, same thing. I mean, the musical in many ways came of age in the Depression.
And you know, in especially this year, such a turbulent time.
Yeah. Which of course I didn't plan on. that wasn't part of my plan.
But okay, maybe Arthur Freed and the musical gods above had something to do.
Oh, great. I don't know if that was worth it then. Arthur might have stepped a little too far.
You might have.
Thanks for trying to help, but
yeah. What? This story, it's sweet, it's old fashioned, it's enchanting. What came first, the idea for the musical or the idea for the story?
The idea for the musical, and the idea for trying to do an old-fashioned musical that would feel new. Mm-hmm. Try to kind of do it in the sort of unironic, unapologetic way that old MGM musicals mm-hmm. did it, but to set it in contemporary, contemporary LA, contemporary reality, a city that you don't often think of as actually all that romantic, mm-hmm. And you know, people kind of struggling day in, day out with sometimes very ordinary problems, just ordinary people, and their lives, and do it in a very realistic yet fantastical way. So mm-hmm. to combine those two things, that's where it came from first.
Mm-hmm. Now, something that really helps with this film, and I kept thinking Norma Kalmus through the whole movie, every frame.
Really?
It's like, oh my God, because Norma Williams, every single Technicolor film ever made.
Yeah, the I remember watching, there's a great documentary, it's like a special feature and something. I think the Blu-ray of The Adventures of Robin Hood, when they released that on Blu-ray, the Errol Flynn mm-hmm. one. And they were talking about the whole history of, I mean, that's one of the most beautiful color, you know, pieces of color photography in history. And talking about just the history of Technicolor and Eastman color and how obviously technical it was at the outset. But I just loved, I became very enamored with this idea that color was a choice and a production in and of itself. So that forced you to really think about color.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people in those movies thought about color palette more than we do mm-hmm. today, because we take it for granted now, you know. But back when most movies were black and white, if you were to shoot a movie in color, you had to make it count. And I wanted this movie to make it count.
And you definitely succeed. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, the sunset, the dance, mm-hmm. The dance against the sunset, and the pinks and oranges. It's right out of Singing in the Rain with Don Lockwood and Kathy Seldon on the soundstage, where he's setting the whole mood with that pink and orange in the background.
Yeah.
So the
fun thing there was like trying, you know, walking around LA, seeing real sunsets and going, wow, that sunset looks just like the painted backdrop in Singing in the Rain, or the painted mm-hmm. backdrop in, you know, American in Paris, or A Star is Born, or something. It's mm-hmm. like these movies that used to be shot mainly on sound stages, so beautifully. Lena Sangre, my DP, and I, we always talked about, like, is there a way to do that in real life? Is there a way to have the same kind of colors, same kind of magic, same kind of fakery? Because we mm-hmm. loved also that those movies would do painted backdrops and not try to make them look real, actually indulge in the fact that they're fake and have fun with that. But if we could do that, if we could make a real LA sky look fake, you know, mm-hmm. and it's just about shooting it at the right time of day. It's really
well,
all it
is. And the fact that you went with anamorphic, and then mm-hmm. of course you had specially ground lenses.
Yeah, yeah.
To really celebrate, you know, the panavistic.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Linus. I mean,
he,
Linus is a genius.
Linus is beyond a genius.
At that stuff. Yeah. Have you gone to talk to him?
Or? I haven't talked. So I've spoken with him in the past.
In the past, yeah. But so he's off in London shooting, which is kind of great after this movie, shooting The Nutcracker. So I think he's having a good time.
I pretty much
a lot
bet.
A lot of painted sets on that one.
I bet he's having the time of his life because he loves color.
Yeah.
You know, and here you made very conscious choices, and I find this interesting because you've got your primary colors. You've got mm-hmm. red, yellow, and blue.
Yeah.
Very vibrant, very alive in your production design, in your costuming. But then you also throw colored lighting on top of that
mm-hmm.
in many sequences. How challenging is that conceptually for you to achieve, you know, the movie painterly look,
mm-hmm.
and the surrealism, but still have it find that right blend so yeah. that it looks okay?
Yeah. I mean, Linus and I found, we actually spent a whole week early in prep. Linus, Mary, Zofri's the costume designer, David Wasco, the production designer. All of us just sat around a table, went through each page of the script and talked about the color palette in each scene.
Mm-hmm.
And very minutely down to like the color of Emma's pencil and the notebook and like the color in her coffee shop of what her apron would be and Ryan's, everything about Ryan's apartment and his coffee mug and, you know, just trying to really think it through. And then, a lot of the color, this is, you know, one thing you learn kind of getting into when you're really trying to think about color in film is you first start thinking of it as just a DP's job, and you as you get into it, you realize it's just as much, obviously, costume designer, production mm-hmm. designer's job. They have to be actually providing the color material, and then Linus figures out how to shoot it. So a lot of the times we would just, you know, Linus would be shooting things actually somewhat naturalistically, with this wonderful European sense he has of how to tease out the magic in everyday mm-hmm. stuff. And then other times, yeah, he would be doing these very theatrical lighting effects, but it was always, even the theatrical stuff had to feel natural. And that to me is the special genius of Linus, is that he's able to go as far out as you can possibly go within yeah. fantasy and theatrical effects, and yet always make it feel somehow homemade. We never wanted anything in this movie to feel too VFX-y. Everything was done mm-hmm. practically. I mean, literally everything, you know, with the exception of outer space stuff when they're in space, was done entirely practically. Mm-hmm. Even stuff you would normally do with VFX. A lot of that, you know, the sunsets, you know, obviously included. So it was just a matter of, like, really trying to... And then sometimes limit the color palette within a scene. Sometimes another misconception you have is, oh, I want the movie to be really colorful. So you just throw a ton of color on screen. All the different colors of the rainbow. You wind up having a shot that doesn't feel colorful. Whereas if you really limit, if you say, this shot is going to be blue and red, you know?
Yeah.
This shot is going to be yellow and green. That's something I really learned from Vincent Minnelli, especially, mm-hmm. is that idea of that the vibrancy of colors rests entirely in counterpoint of mm-hmm. those colors, and the less colors you're counterpointing and the stronger the choices you're making in each of those colors that you're counterpointing,
mm-hmm.
the more you feel it.
Mm-hmm.
So just things like that you kind of learn in the doing and in the researching that we tried to apply.
Yeah, and one of the most spectacular scenes is, of course, that final 9-minute montage, mm-hmm. and Tom Cross's editing is just...
Yeah, he's...
From the opening dance sequence, your shooting of that and the editing of that to that 9-minute montage, mm-hmm. that could be its own short film.
Well, the funny you say that, because that was the first thing in the editing room Tom and I started with, is we did the same thing on Whiplash, because we knew both movies, you know, end with a kind of sustained... a very editing-heavy set piece,
mm-hmm.
and they're kind of what the whole movie is about. So we started off in the editing room with that sequence. We went, mm-hmm. okay, let's figure that out, and let's almost make it a short film of its own, make it as perfect as we feel it can be. And then once we felt like we had edited and polished the last 10 minutes of the movie, then we went back and tried to earn it.
Mm-hmm.
So Tom knows that way of working, and... But yeah, he's brilliant. I mean, he's just... And what I love about Tom, too, even though he's not a musician, I used to be a musician, Tom is not, but he's the most musical editor
mm-hmm.
I've ever known. Even though he hasn't played music, he gets music.
The editing has a very lyrical ebb and flow to
mm-hmm.
it. And you feel
from
that...
slow to fast, from, you know, exactly, curves to straight angles. He's very... Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Does that help... And with this film, because it is a musical, and it isn't music that just stuck in there, it is interwoven in true musical
mm-hmm.
fashion
yeah.
as part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
How helpful is it to you to have somebody like Marius come in as your music producer on it?
It was amazing. I mean, he... first, for a few years, I'd been... I've known Justin Hurwitz, the composer, since college, and so he'd written all the music. And then we needed someone to actually help us, actually make this a reality in terms of like getting the infrastructure set up for how we were actually going
mm-hmm.
to record all of this, getting the musicians and singers assembled, helping Justin sort of kind of create this what became a kind of mammoth sort of system. So we had, you know, obviously Mary's also Steve Kazicki, our music supervisor, just, you know, these, and they worked very closely with Steve Morrow, who was our sound, you know, on set sound person. And then in the mixing, Nick Baxter did all the music mixing. And obviously they were working very closely with our film mixers, Andy Nelson and Eiling Lee and their team. So everyone had to be, it had to be this whole kind of fluid organism that was very, everyone always in dialogue with Justin. And Mary's at the top, you know, and Justin composing everything and orchestrating everything entirely himself, which was, you know, it's kind of unheard of.
The orchestrations are beautiful.
Yeah, composers very rarely orchestrate their own music these days. So that was another old-fashioned approach in the sense, you know, Justin, his idols are people like Bernard Herrmann and Michel Legrand and John Williams. And these are not just composers, but orchestrators.
Yeah.
So you hear, it's not just the melodies you're hearing. They're very melodic, but you're also hearing a particular soundscape. It's about choosing which instrument is doing what. And so you hear a little bit of Michel Legrand, and you go, oh, that's Michel Legrand. It could be no one else. You hear a little bit of Nino Rota or Ennio Morricone, you know it's them.
Just like you can pick a Steiner or a Herrmann.
Exactly.
At the drop of a
whereas a lot of scores, I think these days, are... have become much more generic and much more at the service of, just purely at the service of the other elements of the film rather than being a character in their own right. And I really wanted, obviously, not just because this is a musical, because I really think it's the way I want to make movies in general, I wanted to really have the music be a character in this and be part of the reason you went to see it.
Yeah, and it definitely is is here. And it's like Joe Gershenson, he used to be the arranger up at Universal for decades.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew Joe for many years.
I just love those old music guys, film music guys. It's really, it's some of the great orchestral music of the 20th century is in film. Sometimes unsung, you know, like sometimes not as heralded as it should be.
And I mean, he took me up there on, you know, to sound stages many times.
Oh, that was my favorite part. Maybe my favorite part of the entire process with this movie was when Marius and Justin actually recorded the score. We did it on the Sony soundstage where they did Singing in the Rain, and literally the same room where they recorded Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I mean, it's just kind of...
What does that, for somebody that loves musicals the way you do, the way I do...
I was pinching myself,
how does that
make...
I felt
like a kid in a candy shop with literally 100 musicians assembled on the stage playing real instruments, real human beings blowing air into their horns and their reeds. It feels almost... anachronistic in today's age, you know, and wonderfully so. And then with the images, you know, like particularly that final sequence you were talking about, getting to score that, be on the stage, have them assemble, you know, the 100 musicians, the 50 person choir, you know, just and feeling that sound with, you know, seeing our images projected on the screen. I mean, it was just like, I was like, okay, great. Well, even if everyone hates the movie, this makes it all worth it, because it's just like, it was so amazing being there.
Yeah.
Pinched myself. Yeah.
Now, a directorial challenge had to be working with Mandy and choreographing these huge, your opening number is massive. Mm. We don't see that today.
Yeah.
So often they'll cut down, if somebody's going to have a dance number or even a crowd number, they cut it down to a manageable amount of 20 people, 50 people, and then CGI in the rest.
Yeah, yeah.
You had hundreds of people here.
Yeah, it was about 100 dancers, over 100 dancers, and then obviously a lot of cars. And yet, of course, like the other thing that was tricky is, you know, the dancer you don't see is the camera, and the camera had to be as choreographed as any of the dancers, and because we wanted it to feel like a single shot.
Were you doing handheld on with the cameras, or
not in that scene? No, it was all that was all crane and Steadicam.
Okay,
that scene, yeah. So it was a lot of heavy machinery up there on an elevated freeway ramp, you know, in a heat wave. So it wasn't the most comfortable shoot, and yet moment of the shoot, and yet it was maybe the most exhilarating.
How many takes did you have to do of that one number?
We did about it's three shots stitched together to look like one, and each shot, you know, would range from 20 to maybe 30 takes. You know, something like that. But there were other dance numbers in the movie where, you know, something like Ryan and Emma doing the Hilltop duet dance at Magic Hour. Well, because of Magic Hour, you only have time for, it's a 6-minute shot. You have a half hour window. So we squeezed in about 4 or 5 takes, and we did it over 2 nights. So that's about, you know, I think we probably did maybe 9, 10 takes total over the course of 2 nights. But then something like, you know, some of the stuff like in the final sequence and the Dream Ballet sequence and some of the other kind of numbers where we could do more takes. Yeah, I think we got up into the 40s on some of those bigger dance long dance takes. Mm-hmm. So Ryan, Emma, all the dancers really had to, they had to be in good shape. this was a very athletic shoot.
And yeah, I'm glad you use the word athletic because as I'm watching Ryan, all I kept thinking is Shades of Gene Kelly. If he would pursue dance.
Well, Ryan would kiss you for that because he that's how Ryan and I first bonded over musicals was Ryan is a diehard and has been for a long time Gene Kelly worshiper.
His moves, he has that Gene Kelly athleticism.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so evident watching that, even when he sings. He doesn't have a great singing voice, but neither did Gene.
Yeah, yeah. No, this I love both Ryan's voice and Gene's voice, but I think of them as exactly as naturalistic voices.
Yeah.
In other words, it's how I wanted the whole movie to sound, not belted, not overperformed, that this needed to feel. That was something that I really think is like not talked about that often, but one of the key things of why the old musicals worked is that the singing wasn't so far from the talking. Mm-hmm. They were recorded in somewhat the same way, and they were delivered in somewhat the same way, in this conversational way, so that, you know, nowadays someone starts singing in a movie, and suddenly you hear it's a completely different mic. It's auto-tuned and reverbed and compressed to the wazoo, because that's how albums are recorded now. Mm-hmm. And it's belted as though, you know, as though you're a mile away,
yeah.
Even though you're right up close with the camera. That to me is one of the key mistakes that you know, it's just we wanted to. I just had no interest in.
Well, that's
going down
and I think it's because, you know, in the heyday of musicals, people could go in, see a musical, they could walk out and they could be humming and singing a song, and they didn't sound that terrible.
Yeah, exactly. These were songs also that, and that was something that Justin and Marius were really you know, brilliant at was, you know, I mean, every melody in the movie, every song had been completely sort of written before Ryan and Emma came on, but then to sort of tailor them to their voices, to kind of, you know, find the right keys, to find where the right key changes would be, to sort of, you know, tailor everything,
mm-hmm.
the same way Mandy Moore did with the choreography, have everything be very much speaking to their strengths and their particular idiosyncrasies and their little vulnerabilities, to kind of tease those out and make it inform the music and the dance.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be a two-way street.
I have two things I have to ask you. Number one, you shot in a smokehouse?
Yeah. You recognize that, yep.
I live in the smokehouse.
Do you? Yeah, we lived there for 2 days. That was Ryan's first day of shooting. It was our first week. We'd shot a little bit with Emma, and then that was Ryan's first day. It was playing that super involved, you know, again,
mm-hmm.
one single take, you know, all him, no CG trickery or anything. We didn't have a piano double at all any moment on set. It was always Ryan. So that was he had a very hot day his first day.
Well, I can tell you the smokehouse has never looked more beautiful, and I've been going there over 35 years.
It is a beautiful. Well, I wanted was a restaurant that had that red. You see it. I mean, so to me, it feels very LA. The red booth, the red
mm-hmm.
velvet kind of. And so we found it in the smokehouse, and then yeah, Linus just did a wonderful job lighting it, you know, so it feels kind of dappled and
it's beautiful.
Yeah,
it's beautiful. That should be. They should like take that image and use that on all of their marketing materials. Let me tell
that's
you,
great. Maybe we'll get them some extra business. Not that they need it, but yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, people laughed at me. I said, "That's a smokehouse." They said, "No." I said, "Have
oh,
you
they didn't believe you." Oh,
I
so
said,
funny.
"Oh, trust me."
Yeah,
trust me.
I mean, we faked the, you know, so it's a different exterior that she slips into. But you caught us out
immediately.
Yeah.
But so my last question, what did you learn about yourself as a director, as a filmmaker in the process of making La La Land?
I mean, I learned every single thing on this movie felt a little impossible, you know, but you just try to have faith that you can get there. And I've always kind of, in theory at least, believed that that's the only stuff worth doing, is that you have to set challenges that if it doesn't seem impossible to pull off, then why bother trying to pull it off? I really do believe in that. And that was kind of the credo every day on set with everyone. But I think I really kind of So I guess it's less something I learned. It's more that like this reaffirmed that for me, or it made it real in a way that it had always just been this kind of theoretical thing. But obviously there would be other voices in my head saying like, you know, yeah, but maybe you should hold back, or maybe you should, you know, but you know, I had very, you know, great supportive producers who were pushing me to, anytime they sensed me holding back, they would push me to keep at it and even go further. And so I look back now and I'm really glad that we never made things easier on ourselves, that we did try to shoot for the moon, and in terms of the technical challenges and the emotion, the sort of tonal challenges of the movie, I'm just, there were many moments where we could have taken a slightly easier road, that might have seemed very appealing at the time, and we never did. So that's the one thing I'm probably the proudest of and kind of took the most from.